It is Sunday, November 9th. This is the Football Scoop Podcast. I am Zach Barnett. To my right is John Bryce. On the bottom is Doug Samuels. I'm joined by my esteemed colleagues. Gentlemen, how are we this morning?
Doing well.
Doing great.
Other podcasts will lie to you and pretend that every single Saturday of college football is the greatest ever. We tell you the truth, Football Scoop. This was not a college football Saturday that you're going to remember 10 years from now. The day started in Lubbock, Texas. The game day scene lived up to everything we expected to, and honestly, so did the game. It was a battle early, but Tech jumped up 10-0, led 13-0, and controlled this game throughout. John, I'll start with you. Anything from the game surprise? I know you picked a Tech route, and you were closer to the final score than I was. So what did you think?
Yeah, I just continued, and maybe it was Doug who made the point on Thursday's podcast, the physicality of Texas Tech's defensive line and then what they did to reinvest in their offensive line in the offseason in the transfer portal. And so Tech left a lot of points on the field. That's what stood out to me. Against a better opponent, Tech might have found itself in trouble. And I know BYU was undefeated, but I thought Bear would struggle in that type of road environment. And Tech was never really threatened in that game, but probably should have had 42 or 45 points, bogged down repeatedly in the red zone. But Tech, I thought yesterday, showed it's probably about as physical as any team in college football.
Yeah, the monkey on their back is going to be the red zone offense. That has to improve in order for them to be a legit college football national title contender. And you can tell just from the final numbers, BYU went into that game knowing it was going to be a bear, no pun intended, to run the ball. And they knew that was going to be an uphill battle. And Bear Bachmeier ended up throwing the ball almost 40 times that game. That's got to be a high on the year for him, I would think, and only he threw for less than 200 yards. So they knew going into that, the matchup, that running the ball was going to be tough. They're going to have to rely on him to throw a little bit, and that didn't get the job done.
Yeah, the speculation going into Saturday was after Tuesday night's college football rankings with Tech and BYU obviously in the top 10 and BYU or Utah 13, there was the thought of maybe we could get three teams into the playoff, and the path to three and certainly the path to two would have involved BYU winning yesterday, remaining undefeated, and then Tech getting into the conference championship game with two losses, beating BYU there and getting the automatic bid. Obviously, that's out the window now. But I think Tech has shown they've been so dominant in all their wins. Their one loss was away from home with their backup quarterback. I see a Tech team that can compete with the upper echelons of the SEC and the Big Ten. Would they win those conferences? Probably not. Maybe not. But they would compete with those teams. And I see a Tech team that belongs in the college football playoff, whether they hoist a trophy in Arlington or not. I think they've been powerful enough throughout the season that they're an at-large bid for me at worst. What do y'all think?
Yeah, I think taking care of that game yesterday, a team that debuted in BYU at number 7 in this past week's CFP rankings, I think they've got to get to 10 wins, and that put them at 9-1. But I agree with you. As long as they're sitting 10-2, then they'll be a playoff team, in my opinion.
The exciting game of the noon window was Indiana Penn State, which was, if I guess we could start at the end. If I don't have a vote, but if I did, Fernando Mendoza would be my Heisman Trophy winner, and that play would be the play that jumps out at us from this season, the Omar Cooper Jr. catch. Although Indiana did not have its season on the line, it still felt like regular old college football with an insane win coming down to the wire. What'd y'all think of this one?
Yeah, the ability for Indiana to get the job done without their leading receiver and Elijah Surratt, who we talked a couple weeks ago, you could put in the top 5 football players in college football early in the season. So to do it without him, and Charlie Becker stepped up in a big way, had 7 catches for 118 yards. A couple, one really big one down the stretch there just before the touchdown to get him into the red zone. And every Heisman hopeful has a Heisman moment. And for me, Fernando Mendoza's final drive there with a minute left on the clock, I'm getting chills just talking about it. Like, for him to lead the team down, especially after taking a sack on the first play, and then throw a dart up the seam to he hit a receiver once and then tight end next on two explosive plays to get him down in scoring position. That is, if we look back at the season and Fernando Mendoza is the Heisman Trophy winner, that is his Heisman moment right there.
Yeah, Doug, I couldn't agree with you more. And the second down play, to me, is almost the signature over the touchdown throw. The touchdown throw was a really good throw, and he put it where only his receiver could get it, and then his receiver made just a transcendent play. But Mendoza, what he did on that second down pass is what saved that game for Indiana and saved the Hoosiers' dreams of a perfect season. And then I can't take credit for this stat. I think it's John Tweet Sports, but that's not me. That means that Indiana's final regular season opponents are 2-23. And overall, since Indiana played Michigan State, 5 of their 9 Big Ten conference opponents have a combined 2-29 record. Maryland lost again yesterday at Rutgers. Penn State is winless in the Big Ten. Wisconsin is now 1-5, and Purdue is winless in the Big Ten. So the Big Ten has kind of taken the place of the SEC for many years in terms of being only top-heavy and not having great depth. Big Ten has touted its depth, but that's not the case this year. It's pretty top-heavy with 4 teams, and then the rest of the league is pretty middling.
Yeah, that drive, it's going to go down, that drive, as a 10-play, 80-yard touchdown drive. But, John, I thought you that second and 17 throw saved the game for them just as much as the touchdown did. Really, they went 87 yards in 9 plays after that. And it seemed insurmountable at this point, considering how Indiana's or Penn State's pass rush was just teeing off on Mendoza at that point. And you're starting to, all right, what does Indiana really have in this guy? He joined the college football lexicon, going 99 yards with the boys for Cal against Stanford last season, and might be a number one pick now. Who knows? But he is my Heisman Trophy favorite. And it's wild to me that Penn State's 0-6. I'm looking at a box score that shows them at 0-6. I think Indiana deserves more credit than beating an 0-6 Big Ten team. This was they're not the number two team in the country like they were ranked preseason, but in terms of talent, there's not 15 teams in the country more talented than them. And in that environment, in that circumstances, some of them self-inflicted, but to go out and win this game justifies them as the number two team in the country at this point in my mind.
And I thought that the Penn State quarterback, Ethan Gronkmeyer, for that to be his first major setting like that at home against that type of opponent, I thought he showed himself very well. You could argue he played better on a big stage yesterday than what we have consistently seen out of Drew Aller. So there were some things for Penn State to take from that contest. But, boy, when Penn State couldn't officially grind out the clock, to quote the Avengers, Indiana felt inevitable.
The one thing when we talked Thursday, the one thing I wanted out of my Saturday was to be on on my couch in perfect conditions and watching Oregon and or Iowa have to drive and go score in god-awful conditions. And we got that and then some. Iowa, trailing 15-10, went 93 yards in 12 plays to take the lead. And then Oregon, I believe the stat was Dante Moore had 65 passing yards going into the final drive. They went 54 yards in 10 plays to eke out an 18-16 win that was everything we asked for and then some.
And on that final drive, he threw what might be the dime of the year. Like he threw that fade ball when there was no business completing that.
Oh,
perfect pass, perfect coverage from the Iowa Hawkeye defensive back, and just absolutely dropped it in there. I've been talking about that for the past 12 hours.
Yeah, that throw, you couldn't have put it in a better position with a Monarch. I mean, it was absolutely perfectly placed. And the Iowa defender, I mean, you maybe had like that much space to get the ball into the receiver's hands, and he did it. And that was the play that really catapulted them deep into Iowa territory, where you knew, okay, if nothing crazy happens, Oregon's at least going to get a good look at a field goal here. And then drilled it. And that's the same kid that had missed a couple of key kicks in Oregon's loss to Indiana. So good redemption for him. One of those deals, you never turn down a 12-play 93 yard scoring drive like Iowa had, and they exhausted every last down in the fourth down and goal sequence. But you also worried, especially when they didn't make the 2-point conversion. If you were a Hawkeye fan, you had to feel like you'd left a little bit too much time on the clock, because Oregon has that singular player in Dante Moore and has that overall team speed that you felt one guy slipping on that wet turf, one guy busting a play, and Oregon could house it. And Oregon didn't house it, but they had a couple of crack plays that really proved the difference.
And the difference was about this much in him being inbounds and out of bounds. And I thought for a second, because it was ruled complete on the field, and the best view that CBS had, there was a raindrop on the camera. And I thought for a second, all right, they're going to say it's inconclusive and allow Iowa to keep these points. We all knew the weather would be a factor, but we had no idea to that degree. But I think they got the call right. It looked like he was out of bounds. But I thought the same thing as you. Even in a game at that point that was 16-15, where Oregon hadn't tried to throw the ball at all, you still know they left him too much time. And Gary Danielson kind of joked, throughout the broadcast, that it felt like an Army Navy game where you try to get 10.1 yards and no more, so you can keep the ball. And they did their best, but it wasn't enough. And Dante Moore, I think we could say, was the most impressive 13 of 21, 112 yard, no touchdown, one interception performance in college football history. Probably not a lot of competition there, but Big Ten people were joking after this game that Oregon won the conference last season, but they joined the Big Ten on Saturday, winning a slog at Iowa 18-16. Now they really are Big Ten teams without. Really, probably if they're three top pass catchers on paper, still went out and won the game. They outrushed Iowa 261-101. Dan Lanning has my full respect, especially for enduring that game with no hat and a regular old sweater.
Yeah, the no hat look was just like, with the way the weather was coming down and how soaked he was, that was just like the epitome of I'm a raw alpha male and I'm out here on the sideline and we're here to win a football game. We'll get on the plane and go home then. And then poor Iowa, because, with some of the games left on its schedule, the Hawkeyes could have entered the playoff conversation for real had they been able to hold on to that very late lead. And also the difference in the game is the safety that Iowa had very early in the game, because Iowa was terrible in the first quarter on special teams.
That's what opened up the scoring in the most Big Ten way possible. It would have been either a punt from the plus 35 or a safety, and that game opened up with a safety. Tip of the cap to Will Stein. I know I talked about him on Thursday being one of the top three offensive play callers in college football, and I'm screaming at the TV when they get the ball back, when they get that final possession, a minute 42, and they start off with a four-yard run. I'm like, what are we doing, Oregon? What are we doing? And shows how much smarter Will Stein is than me. And then they go with a four-yard pass, and now they're at third and two, and the rest of that drive is three-yard run. A minute left. I'm still screaming at the TV. 5-yard pass, 8-yard pass, just kind of dinking and diming it down. And then they bust one open with a 24-yard pass, a couple incompletions, a 6-yard pass before they end up kicking that field goal. But the poise that it took with Dante Moore, no one's panicking on the sidelines. They really executed on that final drive, very, very much in the same vein that Indiana did. Just hours earlier, like there was no panic there. It was like they had been there before. And I think Dan Lanning was asked after the game, like, dude, you're at Oregon. You've got probably, space technology for rain gear from Nike. Why are you not in rain gear? And his answer was, I want to feel like I'm in the fight with my players. So he's gotten a cotton crew neck on that's just soaked to the bone, just so he can feel like he's one of his dudes out there. That's pretty awesome.
We thought that there would be an upset of a ranked Pacific Northwest Big Ten team playing on the road at in the Midwest, and we almost got one. But the one we got was in Wisconsin, where a day after officially retaining Luke Fickell for next season, Wisconsin goes out and wins a game where they played three quarterbacks. They were 5 of 17 for 24 yards, and that was the winning team. Wisconsin 13, Washington 10. I don't know that anyone suffered a worse loss on Saturday than Jed Fish did. This was a Washington team that had playoff aspirations. they still have Oregon ahead of them. They controlled their destiny to the extent that they could, being ranked 23rd, and just went out and laid an absolute stinker.
The leading passer for the Badgers, real quick, was their punter, as Zach left that door open to walk through. But their punter was the leading passer in that game. Like that's as Big Ten as it possibly gets right there.
And that was because he completed one pass for 24 yards that I think was in the third quarter. I don't think Wisconsin quarterbacks didn't complete a pass in the first half. Like, that's Big Ten football. Your quarterbacks don't complete a pass in the first half. Four different players threw a pass, at least one pass yesterday for Wisconsin. And you're right, a really damning loss for Washington in the big picture of its season. Tough loss for Jed Fish, who's been mentioned in some of the circles at his alma mater, Florida, as a potential candidate there. And certainly that didn't do anything to help his candidacy.
I think Luke Fickell officially put to rest the team vest. He put that to bed, and he had the black hoodie of death on from Kalen DeBoer, so probably deserves a handwritten thank you note to Kalen DeBoer for switching that up. But I know JB and I disagree that on the move for Chris McIntosh, and I think Zach is probably with JB. But I mean, he took a team that was underfunded in Cincinnati, a Group of Five program at the time, to the college football playoff, brought a lot of his staff there. I know he's turned over coordinators, but I've been to the Wisconsin facilities. That they are not on par with other Big Ten. So they need to invest in facilities and roster. They invest in him. There's no question there, but investing in your coaching staff in today's day and age does not necessarily equal the wins. So him and his guys didn't just forget how to coach. I think they just need some funding.
Yeah, look, I don't think Luke Fickell's a terrible coach. I just think for whatever reason, it's been an absolutely terrible fit at Wisconsin. And if we reviewed that carousel from a couple of years ago, 3 years ago, whatever, I think we all would have given Wisconsin an A at the time, if not an A-plus, for plucking Fickell away from Cincinnati to come coach Wisconsin. And honestly, Fickell probably would have had a great shot at being Notre Dame's coach the previous year had he not guided the Bearcats to the playoffs, and he was unwilling, very nobly unwilling, to leave Cincinnati for a job such as Notre Dame before the playoff run concluded. So I don't think Fickell is a bad coach, but he's been a really bad fit there. And Wisconsin absolutely needs to invest more. There's no doubt about that. But Wisconsin has invested in that roster as well. I mean, right out of your backyard, Doug, they went and took probably the best offensive lineman from Central Michigan and gave him a significant six-figure deal after the end of spring ball this year to get into the portal and come over to Wisconsin. And he started a couple of games for them of late at center. I'm not sure if he started yesterday. I did not study the box score that closely, but they have invested. Are they elite from facilities? Absolutely not. They're not elite in their own conference. Certainly they're not elite nationally, but they've invested better than to have had yesterday snap an 11 game Big Ten or Power Four conference losing streak, whatever it was.
Speaking of punters throwing passes in Big Ten games, Doug, I'm interested in your perspective here. So USC snuck their backup quarterback Sam Heward into their punter's number and faked a punt with him throwing. They won the game 38-17, so I don't think it decided the game by any means. But what's your perspective? Was this fair game or Bush League on USC's part?
So I actually had this in my notes. I wanted to ask you guys the same question and get your take. But, I think it's fair game, number one, because it was the first punt of the game. So it's not like they trotted out a different punter and then this guy. Like, it was the first punt of the game. First punt of the game for USC, so all fair game. Number two, they had Sam Heward listed on the depth chart as number 80. So if you overlook that in your army of support staff and you don't catch that, that's on you. I think the subsequent punts probably should have been penalized if I'm reading Twitter the right way. But I think that's absolutely fair game. That's, you're looking for any edge you can possibly get. You worked within the framework of the rules to do it and found a way to get it done. So I think it was absolutely fair game.
And am I wrong, or did I hear Lincoln Riley say that they'd actually done that 3 games ago? I thought I saw or read or heard that that wasn't the first time USC had listed Heward at number 80 on its roster. I'm pretty sure Lincoln Riley said that in postgame, that it was the third time they had done it and that people just now caught on because USC elected to utilize it. I saw almost that exact same play work last year against USC when Notre Dame slipped Tyler Buchner out onto the field in the Coliseum instead of using punter James Rendell, and they had very similar numbers, and USC never noted. And so I think, if I'm not mistaken from talking to people over the weekend, Chad Bowden maybe was involved in USC inserting that play into its arsenal because Bowden was on the Notre Dame sideline a year ago when the Fighting Irish used it, and now, of course, he's USC's general manager. But same deal. A number that you're not going to either notice, or there's not such a difference in the frames that you're not paying that much attention to it. But I'm like you, Doug, with all the support staff that you have, that needs to be something combed over. And I bet every team in college football now today in staff meetings will be assigning somebody to check depth charts moving forward against what the player jerseys are wearing.
And Bowling Green did it last year. Scott Loeffler's team did a they threw a fade ball up the left sideline to a guy and did the same thing. So it's not something new. Everything's stolen at this point, as I think I wrote on earlier this week. Like there's no original ideas. You're just stealing it and putting your own spin on it.
Yeah, I originally came down as Bush League, but allowed by the – if it's within the rules, then it's the rules problem, not USC's problem. But then I honestly wasn't aware they put him in the depth chart as number 80 or on the roster. So at that point, it's on Northwestern. I tend to think it's an underhanded move that I wouldn't be sad if the NCAA found a way to outlaw this type of thing because it feels cheap to me. But at the same time, I'm also wondering, why doesn't every team make their punter wear the same number as their backup quarterback as long as they're, you know, within reason size-wise? It seems like that'd be a clear advantage. But in my opinion, I think this type of thing should be outlawed. But if your punter could throw a pass, more power to him. But sneaking your backup quarterback out there, I think that's Bush League, but I don't fault people for taking advantage of the rules.
Mark Penn State down is a team that will not be able to try this because their punter is like 6'7", 305.
Yes.
Yeah, 290 or something. Yeah,
I was going to say I couldn't remember who had the massive punter, so I'm glad you brought that up.
Unless you got Jared Lorenzen 2.0 hanging around on the sideline or something, you're not getting away with that one, Penn State.
RIP to the hefty lefty. How fun was he to watch?
All right, let's go to the ACC next. Saturday was just about as bad as that conference could have hoped for, considering Louisville lost to Wake Forest. Louisville lost to Cal. Virginia lost to Wake Forest. Virginia looked like a completely different team without Chandler Morris at quarterback, and we see why he commanded the money that he did. I just kind of want to go general thoughts here. My general thought on the ACC is Clemson and Florida State threatened to blow up this conference without a clear exit strategy over because they wanted to be paid more than everyone else. And they worked out a deal where the teams that bring in the TV ratings will go make the most money. Everyone said, all right, I guess that's fair. This Saturday, Florida State was at Clemson. Everyone in – over the offseason, thought, okay, well, that'd be an ABC game, get 6-7 million viewers, and we will rake in the appropriate cash. And instead, that game was on ACC Network, which is not rated, so that will be officially worth $0 under the success initiative to both programs. And I think that sums up this conference perfectly fine.
What do you mean it's not rated? What does that mean?
I don't know the mechanics of this, but for you, you have to submit – and pay money into Nielsen and whatever their competitors are for them to track how many people watch your network. And obviously the more people that watch your network, the more you can charge for ads. And so the ACC and SEC network, for reasons I can't explain, they don't do that. So there could have been 400,000 people watching that game last night or 4 million. And in the end, it's still going to count for zero either way.
Well, I'll tell you.
I did not know that.
Yeah, I didn't realize that both of those networks were not rated. I knew ACC was not rated for whatever reasons. But I'll tell you what, I'm sure enough people had eyeballs on the ACC yesterday to confirm that league as a one-bid league. It's just not very good at all. And now you've got a crazy logjam scenario at the top. I mean, if Pittsburgh wins out, that would give them – the Panthers would have a win over Notre Dame. They would have two early season losses. So if Pittsburgh won all the way out and then maybe lost an ACC championship to somebody, it might give the ACC two bids in that scenario, but I can't really see one beyond that unless Pittsburgh won out and then Georgia Tech won out and then Pittsburgh beat Georgia Tech in the ACC championship. But Georgia Tech would only be a two-loss team and would have a win over Georgia. So I guess that scenario is crazy enough to get the ACC two bids. But otherwise, barring something like that, I just don't see the ACC being a two-bid league, and I don't think – overall, it is proved that it deserves two bids this year.
Yeah, Jeff Brohm, I've gone on my stump for Penn State to hire him, as he checks a lot of boxes that James Franklin failed to do. But one glaring weakness in his game is that he beats basically every top five team he plays. So either he never loses, or he loses games he probably shouldn't, and he loses games he probably shouldn't, including the Cal. Although, as mediocre as that conference is, I want to join the chorus. And Brock Osweiler was gushing about it after nearly every play, and I was there with him on JKS. I'm not going to try and say his name. The true freshman lefty quarterback. As a fellow lefty, I got to stand up for every lefty quarterback there is. He's insanely accurate. And when he doesn't throw a ball that's not a 10 out of 10 bullseye, it's shocking to me. So I hope for college football's sake that Cal is able to keep him, because they got – an absolute dude at quarterback for at least the next 2 years after this one.
Yeah, Brown gave him a lot of credit after the game, saying that it's kind of the first accurate throwing quarterback they've seen all year, which I think is a big tip of the cap to him. And he threw for over 300 yards, 30 of 47 on the night. But yeah, that definitely puts a chink in the armor of the Jeff Brohm. You know, is he a giant killer? Yeah, I would love to see Jeff Brohm with some place where you can recruit the absolute best in America and see what he does with that, because he has not been at one of those programs and he's been a giant killer. So I'd love to see that.
I'm full endorsement agreement with you, Doug. Like, Jeff Brohm at Florida would terrify a lot of SEC coaches, and Jeff Brohm at Penn State with those resources would terrify a lot of Big Ten coaches, especially because he already terrified a lot of Big Ten coaches at Purdue. And that's a place where the facilities have been severely lagging and where it's really hard to recruit to. And it's a basketball school that wants to do okay in football. So yeah, that's been Brohm's MO. Like you said, ZB, he will absolutely cut down the beanstalk, and then he will absolutely spill his beans all over against somebody that he has no business losing to.
And probably the most frustrating result for the ACC office yesterday was Miami 38, Syracuse 10, simply because Miami either plays like a national championship contender or a team that forgot how to play football over the previous week, and with seemingly no in between. There's no shame in losing to Louisville, but there's no reason for them to go out and lose that SMU game and then go out and pummel Syracuse. So even though they beat Notre Dame, they're well on the outside looking in the playoff at 18 right now. So that's probably going to be too high a hill to climb, blah, 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 for the ACC's most talented team. All right, that's enough about the ACC. Let's go to the SEC. Honestly, kind of a boring day an uneventful day in the SEC. Let's start with the one ranked matchup was Missouri at A&M. I have a lot of Aggie fans mad at me this morning for tweeting that A&M's 6-0 start, or their presumed 7-0 start, is against four teams that have fired their coaches in the SEC. A&M's played all four of them. They played a Missouri team yesterday that was playing a true freshman third string quarterback who went through for 77 yards in that game. And then this week they get South Carolina, who's fired their offensive coordinator and their offensive line coach. That's true. What also is true is I think A&M might very well be the best team in this conference. If they have a weakness, their schedule sure hasn't exposed it. Let's say that.
Their receiving core is really, really good. And going and getting Casey Concepcion away from NC State has just taken that offense under Colin Klein to an entirely other level. Marcel Reed's still not the most accurate dude in the world at quarterback, but he just makes plays. He extends plays. And with that receiving core, when he extends plays, they're almost impossible to cover. And then those dudes go track the ball down if he's not perfectly accurate. So that is a very complete A&M team, and one that I saw in person early this season at Notre Dame. But yesterday's win at Missouri in that atmosphere, when Missouri late in the first half was driving to potentially tie the game at 7-all in plus territory, and the quarterback gets hit, maybe blindside hit, I think, coughs off the football. A&M snags it out of the midair, races all the way back inside the 5-yard line, punches it in a couple of plays later, right before the half, to take a 14-0 lead. And Missouri showed some fight after that, but that sequence in the final 90 seconds before halftime, that middle eight win, proved the difference for Texas A&M in terms of setting the foundation of it becoming a runaway victory for the Aggies.
I had a thought earlier this week that what Mike Elko has brought to Texas A&M defensively is what I think the fan base wanted Jimbo Fisher to bring offensively. Like they're top of the line defensively in almost every major defensive category. They're a unit you don't want to see on the field. And then offensively, they play very complimentary football. And I had to get that off my chest.
Oh, yeah, that's a great point, Doug. There's a clip out there of Eli Drinkwitz detailing in one, like 45 seconds of time, all the struggles that they had in pass protection against A&M. It would take a layman like me probably 2 hours to unpack all that. And he just recalls it like it's yesterday's lunch menu. But I think that's the exact best way to put it. And then offensively, Colin Klein is pushing all the right buttons. Casey Concepcion, I haven't seen an A&M receiver with his type of burst. And he's a guy that if he doesn't already, is going to have a type of gravity like a – I'm not saying he's this type of player, but like Jeremiah Smith has for Ohio State, that opens up things for everyone else with the Aggies, for a Mario Craver, a Ruben Owens, a Le'Veon Moss when he's back, a Terry Bussey. Terry Bussey is a 5-star that on old A&M teams, they would have tried to get him the ball 15 times a game simply due to lack of options. He touched the ball one time yesterday, which seems incredible, and they still won going away. So this A&M team is legit in every way, shape, and form, at least to me so far against this schedule.
Yeah, I think Concepcion should be in the conversation as like best portal acquisition for any team in America. And Mendoza's up there for sure for what he's done at Indiana, absolutely. And that's probably – he's probably number one. But I think you put Concepcion on your starting offense, all portal team, and he you were talking about A&M receivers, Zach. Christian Kirk was – super dynamic, but I think Concepcion is a better receiver.
I think that's fair. I think that's a good comparison. So I said earlier that there was an uneventful day in the SEC. That wasn't entirely true. Auburn went to overtime with Vanderbilt, and that Auburn looked like a team that had the weight of the world lifted off its shoulders. Its offense looked like it had a lot more clarity in what it was doing, and it still wasn't enough to get the win with Vanderbilt pulling it out in overtime. Doug, in a tie game with just over a minute left, well within field goal range, Vanderbilt went for it on 4th and 1, didn't get it. What'd you think of that call?
Call I didn't see, but I feel like when you have guys like Diego Pavia that just exude confidence, it's really hard to not make that call. So, you know, and they do so many good things option-wise that give you multiple options with the football in a down like that, and a quarterback that's going to will himself pass what you need to get. That's a call I'll always stand behind. As long as you're putting trust in your players to go execute, it's a tough one to buck that trend.
Yeah. Ultimately, Vanderbilt did what it had to do, got to 8-2. The Doors get a bye week, and then they close at home with Kentucky and at Tennessee. They were down a little bit in the college football playoff rankings this past week, somewhere in the late teens, I think. Yeah, 16. I'm not convinced that if they went out, they're a surefire in, but their only chance to get in is by winning out for sure. And that Tennessee has been eliminated, but we'll have a chance to probably do the same to Vanderbilt. And that will be one of the more meaningful games in the Tennessee-Vanderbilt rivalry in all of its years.
I mean, I know you might need to plug yours for this, JB, but they got Kentucky too, and Kentucky has been playing well the past 2 weeks. That's not going to be a walk-away win either.
Yeah, no, you're exactly right. And those two have played some crazy games. Vanderbilt and Kentucky, I mean, have played some absolutely crazy games through the years. But for as good as we saw some interim coach teams look yesterday, Florida was not that. Florida absolutely was dreadful, ended up benching DJ Lagway when he was after he had thrown three interceptions. Kentucky had the energy in that game. Florida, it looked like, just couldn't recover from leaving it all on the field against Georgia.
So I'm glad you brought that up about a 10-2 Vanderbilt, John, because it led me into something else I wanted to talk about. And I count currently 14 Big Ten, SEC, and Notre Dame teams that are undefeated, one loss or two loss. And the assumption nationally is that every single one of them is a lock to make the playoff if they finish 10-2. And not all those teams are going to finish 2. Simple mathematics tells us that 10-2 or better. But I think there's a lot of teams out there. Those 14 teams are probably competing for 8 spots. I'm looking at ACC getting 1, the Big 12 getting 2, and then the group of 5. That leaves 8 spots for those 14 teams. We're probably going to end up with no more than 8, 10-2 or better teams from those two conferences plus Notre Dame. But there's also a chance that there's a 10-2 team left out.
Yeah.
I don't know who that's going to be, but Vanderbilt strikes as one of those. Because, yeah, they'll beat Tennessee most likely. Tennessee at that point would finish 8-4. Missouri was ranked when they beat them. They might have more losing. They still have to play Oklahoma. They have more losing ahead of them. LSU is probably going to struggle to get to 6 wins. South Carolina was ranked when Vanderbilt beat them. They're not ranked anymore. There's not a whole lot of meat on that bone for Vanderbilt.
No, there's not. That's why I couldn't have disagreed more with the sentiment out there that, like, oh, Vanderbilt survived, just win your final two games and you're in the playoffs. No, you're not when you can't say that when you're sitting at 16. And certainly teams in front of the doors will move up some because two teams immediately in front of them, Virginia and Louisville, lost. But to your point, Zach, there's still some craziness to the CFP equation. And your ACC champion and your group of five representative may not be top 12 teams. They may be teams ranked behind the doors, but they still get the last two spots in the 12-team field.
And that's not even counting potentially a Texas that, let's say, beats Georgia Saturday night, beats Arkansas, and then loses to an undefeated A&M, or an Oklahoma that, let's just say, beats Alabama and then loses at home to Missouri or LSU. So,
this
could be quite a log jam in the bottom half of that bracket.
If you like the college football playoff, this might be the scenario that forces them to expand it to 16 teams instead of 12. But the deadline's December 1st, and all those conference championship games aren't played until December 6th. So that's just a subplot to watch the remainder of November.
Yeah, that's going to inspire a rant in me that we are way too deep in this podcast to get to. But the fact that they're trying to expand something that hasn't even happened yet, really, we don't have time for that. All right, so we are 38 minutes in. We are, for all our listeners, we are using a free StreamYard account today. That's why you see that logo in the top screen. Scott's here, so we're rolling with a backup quarterback on the road, and sometimes you got to do what you got to do. So I think this stream might cut us off at 45 minutes. So what do we have? What do we need to talk about that we haven't talked about yet?
Real quick, Division II football. Ferris State got taken absolutely down to the wire. Had to win in double overtime against Saginaw Valley. Saginaw Valley is coached by a former Ferris assistant, Ryan Brady, that's coached on offense and defense as a coordinator. So Ferris got taken down to the wire and had to pull one out. And then Stan in D2, Northern Michigan pulled out, I believe, an overtime win against Davenport. Northern Michigan's head coach Shane Richardson resigned earlier this week after being placed on administrative leave. They found a way, I believe, in double overtime to get a win, running some split back veer stuff that they've been running for the past 2 years. So it was a funky win, but it was, I think, maybe their first GLIAC win in probably 3 or 4 years.
For me, real quickly, Hawaii absolutely woodshedded San Diego State last night. Did not see that coming. That pushed the Rainbow Warriors to 7-3 on the season. A phenomenal job by that coaching staff. Phil Longo and Sam Houston State got their first win last night. One of the sloppiest, most insane final 2 minutes of a game that you'll ever see. If you guys didn't stay up foolishly and watch it like I did, then I promise you it will be worth the 2 minutes of your time. And then Montana, maybe the most painful ending to a game you will ever see at the FCS level. Montana had been in complete control. Try to fake punt late to just keep the ball and grind out the clock. Didn't work. Eastern Washington scored, got the onside kick. It's 29-24. They're all the way down inside the 5-yard line. The quarterback is getting ready to spike the ball, takes the snap, fumbles the snap on the attempted spike. Montana Edge dives in from the left end and recovers the fumble, and that's how Montana manages to stay perfect and secure the 29-24 win. I've never seen a game end on a failed spike, and that's exactly what happened.
That'll be in the leftovers tomorrow for those looking forward to it.
I'm always looking forward to the leftovers. That's a great Monday content piece.
Some leftovers sounds good to me right now. Gentlemen, this has been the Football Scoop Podcast. Thank you for tuning in. We will be back Tuesday.